thing, and my impression was that the people at Second Life would like to go in much the direction I was outlining. So I think there's probably some concordance there.
Yep, I think you're probably right. Folks, I'm going to have to leave you because I have to get back up the mountains to my training session. Stephen, good luck, and thanks again, Jeff, for everything.
Thanks very much. Talk to you soon.
I'll talk to you soon, okay?
Thank you, Gavin.
Bye.
Thanks, Gavin, for teleporting down the island. For teleporting up down the mountain. Bye.
All right. And if I could get someone to volunteer to take the Yugma, someone who can look at Steven's visuals, and would you recommend the slide share? Probably the PowerPoint would make for better visuals. If someone in the Yugma can take control of it and kind of go through the PowerPoint slides as Steven is talking, any volunteers?
Silence.
I bet Sen Kathy would be really good at that. Kathy, if you are available to do that, please let me know. And, okay, you are in the chat room. Very good, Stephen. Jose, thank you very much.
Is Kathy taking that job, Jeff? Because I'd be happy to do it. I just have to get to the Yugma.
That's okay. With your bandwidth and other issues, Jose has volunteered. I think he's going to head in.
Wonderful. Okay. This is Vance in Abu Dhabi, by the way. Nice to meet everybody here.
Oh. Oh, cut and paste doesn't work.
In the chat room, it's finicky for some people in some situations.
Translate that to not working for me. Okay.
I didn't want to interrupt anything, but here's the dead airspace. I might as well say that you're at the Webheads in Action Online Convergence, the second rendition, 2007, and we're very pleased to have Stephen Downs join us. And we've been listening to allusions to his work as we've been in Second Life. And we're very pleased to have you here, Stephen, and looking forward to hearing what you'll have to tell us. And that's our...
Thank you.
Yeah, that's our in, I think.
That's our in. Is that what I'm on?
Well, no. Before we do, we're getting comments that your PowerPoint is not accessible.
Okay. Should be accessible.
I
assume accessible in the sense of it won't download
as it's forbidden.
Forbidden.
Which makes it so much more tempting.
Sorry, yes it is. It's the tempting of fruit. Give me 1 second on that. Sorry about that. This is one of the quirks of my new server. And the quirk is that anytime I upload something, it doesn't give anyone any permissions to read it.
And your audio is okay. It's a little bit... You sound a little bit distant from the mic.
All right. How's this?
A little better.
Okay. Continuing to test that. A little better? This is about as close as it gets.
Okay. There we go. That was better.
All right. So I have to talk a wee bit louder as well then. Okay. Now, blue files. And scrolling down all the way down. FTP command, chmod, read. Oh, I'll give you write to, why not? Okay, it should now be accessible if somebody wants to give that a try.
Roger that. Oh, wait, that's a slide share. Oh, no.
The slide share.
Okay, I'm sorry, yes, it is accessible.
The other one is good. That makes me happier. Okay, let's close that then. Back over to here.
And I should mention, anyone who's in the Yugma that wants to record it for any reason, you can do so by clicking Start Recording.
And you will be recording the audio here on WorldBridges as well,
yes,
correct?
It'll be The raw audio will be posted online in less than 2 hours.
Ooh, raw audio. I love it.
Yes. All right. Well, we should... Well, we're getting the slides queued up on the Yugma.
Okay.
Alright, but I'd say whenever you're ready to roll, we can roll.
Okay, I'm ready anytime.
Let's go.
Much. Okay, well, hello everyone, and my name is Stephen Downs. I'm calling in to you from beautiful, not so sunny Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada. As we've been, we have a long weekend right now. George, I saw, was commenting about presenting yesterday on a Saturday during a long weekend. My thought was he should try Sunday morning on a long weekend. So it is a long weekend, and so of course we've had pouring rain for the last few days and no sign of it stopping. Thank you all for coming here today. I'm sort of monitoring the chats. I say sort of because I have a bad habit of looking away from the chat when I'm talking on long, but I'm sort of monitoring the chat. So if you do have comments or questions anytime through, do feel free to post them in the chat. Vance or Jeff or David or whomever, is there any way for them to pop into the audio as well?
Yes, there is.
Okay, you should feel free then as well to pop into the audio if you would like to comment by audio mode. The conversation mode always works best in an online environment like this, so I would certainly encourage you to pop into the audio and engage pretty much at any time during this talk. We've got about an hour, maybe a bit less now. I'm not going to talk for the entire hour. I'd like to leave a little bit of time at the end. Basically, unless you guys interrupt me, I'm going to talk pretty much uninterrupted. So I encourage you to interrupt me. I'm clicking slides, and I'm looking at the overview slide now. And basically, this breaks down into four major parts. I'll talk very briefly about artificial intelligence and expert systems, then segue to learning design, hopping over after that to the connectivist, it should be connectionist alternative, although connectivist would work there as well, so I just didn't mean to use the term. It's force of habit. And then finally wrapping up with personal learning and a look at what I think personal learning environments should look like. Clicking slides. I'm beginning with the topic of expert systems because expert systems are a very old technology. The idea of expert systems has been around for a good 30, 40 years. The idea of an expert system is that we can create a computer program that would replicate the way an expert makes decisions. And if you picture it in your mind, suppose you go to the doctor's office, right, and you've got some sort of pain. Of course, you're not an expert, so you have no idea what's going wrong with you. But you go into the doctor's office, and the doctor's sitting there, and you say, "Doc, I got a pain." And the first thing the doctor does is starts to ask questions, right? Well, where is the pain? Well, it's in my abdomen. What kind? Is it sharp, or is it, oh, it's sharp, Doc, it's sharp. You go through the series of questions, and what the doctor does is, through the questions, narrows down what it is, and he says, "Ooh, you have acute appendicitis. We better get you to a hospital, stat." Right? And so it's basically a process here of using questions and, based on the answers to those questions, navigating through a representational space such that after you've gained enough information, you can recommend a course of action. So there's two major aspects then to the expert system. First of all is the representational system. That's some sort of description of the world, usually a description of the world in sentences or something. I'm looking at Dennis Phoenix saying, "Where are the slides?" Nobody's answering him. So if somebody can answer him, that would save me from having to type during my talk. I'd appreciate that. The second thing, and the major thing about expert systems, is the inference engine. And this consists of a set of if-then rules. If this, then that. So if it's a sharp pain, then ask, well, where is the pain located? If it's a dull pain, then ask, have you been on medication? Those sorts of rules. Okay, here we go. Here comes the, all kinds of links. Good stuff. The analogy that is probably familiar to most people is the wizard. It's sort of an iffy analogy, but it's not bad. And if you've used a software wizard to install software or to try some sort of task using software, then you'll have sort of a sense of the way the expert system works. And it'll guide you through some sort of predefined path where you are making choices, options, and then it's going to present different sorts of screens to you depending on what sort of options. Of course, Microsoft Word is filled with those kind of wizards. Clicking slide. And something just popped on my Skype. I don't know what...
It was me. I'm sorry. I'm just trying to track down a little bit of background noise. Do you have background noise where you are, or is there someone
unmuted? I may have background noise.
Okay, no problem. If it's unavoidable, I just wanted to mute it if I could.
Yeah, okay. It's a little unavoidable. You see, your timing is awful. Hang on. Is that better?
Yes, it is. Thank you. Sorry.
Excellent. Okay. Continuing on. Oh, okay. It started a different chat, that's why. Okay, silly thing. So I'm on the slide now that says properties of expert systems. And expert systems, like I say, they're software applications. They use programs, which means they're based on sets of inference rules. Consequently, they're goal-oriented. They're looking for some sort of specific outcome, whether to install a piece of software or to diagnose a disease or some such thing. They're intended to be efficient. They're intended to go straight as quickly as possible from a state of not knowing to a state of knowing. There's no detours or side directions or anything like that. And they should be adaptive. They should be responding and changing form depending on what the user's input is. Clicking slide. Well, this puts a large onus on the designer. It puts the onus of being able to get the knowledge into the system, knowledge acquisition on the part of some sort of subject matter expert. It requires some way of knowledge representation. Just trying to have quiet. All right. And this generally entails the creation of learning resources of some type. And then it requires the actual encoding of the knowledge, the creation of the if-then structures. And in the early days of artificial intelligence with languages like Lisp and all of that, this would take a long time, and this would be the core process of creating artificial intelligence, was the creation of these if-then rules. Slide. Learning design is something quite a bit more recent. It's less than 10 years old. Learning design is a mechanism for presenting learning resources to learners. As James Dalziel says, it focuses on technology to automatically run the sequence of student activities, facilitated, of course, by the educator. It's intended to be technology neutral and pedagogy neutral. It's intended to simply outline a process, although typically when we think of learning design, we're thinking of some sort of programmed learning, if you will, that's taking place on a computer or with the aid of a computer. Click. That's funny, I have a cat who's just jumped up into my lap right now. IMS learning design is the major specification. It's based on the education modeling language authored by Rob Koper. And the idea here is to capture different types of instruction, different modes of instruction. Some examples in the IMS documentation include programmed instruction, they include role play, they include competency-based learning. The idea here is the learning design itself is pedagogically neutral, so that an instructor can set up any sort of learning scenario. There's in the documentation, there's a fair amount of discussion about using learning design to set up collaborative activities. For example, a conference taking place, say, at the European Union or some sort of international organization. Clicking. If you look at this slide, competency-based learning, and this comes directly from the IMS specifications, you can see the use of artificial intelligence-type structures. You see the little diamonds there in the diagram represent if-then rules, and depending on the answer to each if-then rule, you're going to take a different path through the instructional material. And the idea here is that each time you have an if-then rule, you present a different instructional resource. Either you present another question or you present some resource, and they work through the resource, and then there's an outcome from working through that resource. Clicking on slide again. The conceptual model of learning design is, well, it's like a play that's taking place, and the students and the instructors have roles in this play, and the learning design itself is almost like the direction of that play. So each person fulfills their roles, and then depending on how they fulfill their role, the learning design application tells them what to do next, to read this, to try that, to perform such and such an activity. And you can see why it can be done both online and off, right? Because if you have a mechanism like this, it's basically a plan for directing activities, and the plan itself is independent of any underlying framework. It's independent of the computer on which it runs. Although really, for all practical purposes, you need some sort of software to run it, because learning design is written in XML. It's really hard to just look at an XML document and just decide what to do from that. Clicking slide. There are various tools involved to create and run learning design. Copper author tool is from the Open University in the Netherlands, and that's probably the main one, and that's gonna come out of Rob Koper's group again. Also, Reload is another one, not listed on this slide, although it should be. It wasn't in the original source. Is LAMS, Learning Activity Management System. Clicking slide. You can see from this slide the sort of thing that learning design sets up. And it's this Lego model of learning resources that we've been working with ever since the beginning of the development of things like learning objects. The idea that you have learning resources and that they're plugged together and delivered as little packets of content in different way. And what learning design does is arrange the Legos in different way depending on the user's response. But it's still a model where you have content. The content has been pre-created by a developer or an instructor, some sort of expert in the system, and then presented as content to a user. The user will need to do some activities at the other end, but the actual creation of the content is completely in the hands of the instructor or the instructing organization. Next slide. This one is titled The Learning Refinery. And the idea here is that the concept of the refinery is that the instructional material by being presented over and over again and worked on over and over again becomes more and more refined, becomes more and more, if you will, perfect. And then these nearly perfect learning resources are embedded inside a much larger architecture designed specifically for the delivery of these learning resources. As Greller says, learning designs by themselves are of limited value without a bundle of surrounding documentation, metadata, and taxonomies. In other words, you need this representational system. You need these learning objects. You need some idea of how all of these learning objects fit together. You need the ontology, the vocabulary to describe these learning objects. All of that needs to be in place before a learning design really becomes useful. And this is very much the artificial intelligence model. This is having everything all set up ahead of time so that all you have to do is crank, turn the crank on the side of the machine and out pops the right answer. And that's been the promise of artificial intelligence, like I say, for more than 30 years. But one thing that we've noticed is it hasn't worked. We don't have artificial intelligence. People have been working on this. The latest instantiation of this is the semantic web. And the semantic web is the same sort of thing, right? You have all your facts written as triples. You have all of your rules and all of that. And you're supposed to turn out the crank, and the semantic web will recommend the right vacation package for you or whatever. But it hasn't worked. Again, with the semantic web, just like artificial intelligence, we have a lot of promise, but we don't have a whole lot of delivery. Click slide. Connectionism. I liked this picture from Marvin Minsky. Marvin Minsky, along with Seymour Papert, are two major authors in the field of connectionism. Connectionism was presented as an alternative to artificial intelligence, where artificial intelligence was based on precise rules and processes and inferences and predefined knowledge. Connectionism was exactly not that. The artificial intelligence was symbol-based and rules-based. Connectionism is not symbol-based. It's not rule-based. It's analogical, where the artificial intelligence is symbolic, as you can see from this diagram. Clicking slide. The feature of connectionism is that it is, to use Minsky's word, messy, as opposed to the nice, neat framework that is artificial intelligence. If you look at any sort of application of learning design, for example, you see that basically you've got one picture that describes all the activities that everybody's going to take. It's one structure created for everybody, and everybody follows the rules of the director, as opposed to the model that Minsky presents, where you don't have one single model. Rather, you have a whole bunch of autonomous, independent agents, each trying to do its own particular thing, whatever it is it's trying to do. And in this case, it could be trying to learn new ways to learn. When I was first presented with learning design, I was presented with the analogy of the play and the director and the roles. And my first reaction was, well, what about improv? Could you do improv with this? But the thing is, there isn't room for improv in learning design. In learning design, you have to follow the rules, otherwise it's not learning design. I see in the comments, it sounds like a theory of cat herding. Yeah, except there's no herder. The cats herd themselves. This is the whole point. Artificial intelligence is directed. Artificial intelligence is controlled. It's operated. There is a central objective. You're trying to get to a certain purpose or goal. But there's no such thing in a connectionist system. The connectionist system is merely a bunch of interconnected individuals, each trying to do their own thing. Click slide. And Teresa says, so we're connectionists. Yes, exactly. And this is where the internet comes into play. This is where the internet becomes really important, where it really the internet isn't organized and run and dedicated toward a certain objective or objectives, but really the internet consists of a whole bunch of individual autonomous agents, each trying to find out how to do their own thing in their own way. The internet, the web of learners, is a connectionist network. It's not a type of artificial intelligence. And if you think about it, can you imagine trying to structure the internet so that it was designed, so that it responded with particular answers to particular questions? It almost boggles the mind. Although, if you think about it, that is exactly the project of the semantic web. The project of the semantic web is to gear the internet toward the finding of resources, the solving of problems, all of that. Clicking slide. Now, the way people learn is different in a network than it is in an artificial intelligence kind of environment. In a network, rather than running through a series of questions, answers, rather than it being rule-based, what happens is you interact with the rest of the network. You send information back and forth. You ask questions. You give answers. You do what you're trying to do. And in that network, you see patterns of behavior, patterns of activity. You think about it a meme or a common idea might suddenly arise in the internet, like the way everybody is watching that Web 2.0 video. Do you remember that Web 2.0 video? It just seemed like one day everybody was watching it. That's how you knew it was a good resource that you might want to go see. You just saw from all the activity taking place that, oh yeah, this is something I want to see. And I bet you if you think back, it's, to when you first saw that video, it's even hard to remember where exactly you first learned of it. It's just like all of a sudden everybody was talking about it. Click slide. The idea of a connectionist system is that concepts or types or items of knowledge are represented by patterns of connections in the system. I'm on the slide titled Distributed Representation right now. So the idea, for example, of that Web 2.0 video, that becomes prominent. That becomes something that you recognize when it shows up in a variety of locations on the internet. Something else, like the Shift Happens video, that would be another pattern, and in the same network, embedded I don't want to use the word embedded, but the same people that would recognize or that would link to the Web 2.0 would also link to the Shift Happens video. So we have this network that's able to absorb different concepts, and each one of these concepts is presented in a slightly different way by this network, and you learn by being a part of this network and interacting with the other nodes of this network. You learn by immersing yourself in a network rather than being separate, with the expert on one side and you on the other side, and you asking questions and the expert delivering answers to you. And this is a large point of connectivism. George Simmons' connectivism is that what we know is actually embedded in the network. And George says, I keep my knowledge on the network, or I store my knowledge on the network. What's happening here is that you're knowing how to do something is actually you being embedded in a network of people who collectively know how to do something. So you can contact or ask people in that network to give you the answer if you don't have the answer. Although, again, I don't like the question-answer kind of model. The learning actually comes from being embedded and being part of the network. It's the network, to use another common phrase. The network is like your community of practice, and you learn by becoming a member of that community of practice. Clicking slides. Here we have the distributed representation, where we have three different concepts all embedded in the same network. I'm looking at the questions here that are showing up on the screen. We have Dennis saying, the dancer becomes the dance has been expanded to many other settings. Indeed, I agree. How is this gravitation to enlarging patterns different from a swarming mentality? That's okay. That's a bit of a digression, Kathy, but I think it's an excellent question. And the answer is that there are different kinds of networks. Some networks are good networks in that they will allow you to reliably obtain information. They will not lead you astray. They won't lead all the lemmings off the cliff, if you will. And other networks are not good networks. And the properties of good networks are mathematical properties. There are ways of slowing down the transmission of information in a network so that there's a chance for that information to be evaluated, if you will, or put up against alternative or conflicting types of information. If you think about it in terms of populations and diseases, if everybody shakes hands with everybody and a disease passes by shaking hands, then as soon as one person has the disease, it's going to spread rapidly through society. And there'd be no chance to stop it. But if everybody shakes hands with just a couple of other people, it's going to take some time for that disease to spread through society. And so consequently, there will be an opportunity for the society as a whole to respond to that disease. So the question now becomes, well, what are the properties of a good network as opposed to the properties of a bad network? What the bad network allows what are called cascade phenomena. That's the swarm phenomena. And the good networks prevent that from happening by having alternative competing states. So in other papers, I've described the properties of good networks under what I call a semantic principle. And in the good networks, the entities in the network are diverse, they are autonomous, they are connected, and the network as a whole is open. And so networks that preserve those four properties will be networks that are able to resist this swarm phenomenon. I hope that answers the question. It's kind of a digression, but I think it's a useful digression. Storing versus knowing, information versus knowledge. I'm using some of these things interchangeably. You know, I don't like the terms knowledge and information or even storing and knowing. A lot of these are rooted, the meanings of a lot of these are rooted in a philosophy where knowledge is representational, where knowledge consists of sentences, where the knower is separated from the known. This expert system, question-answer sort of thing. I'm not completely happy with that. My picture of knowledge is a bit different, where I say that to know something is to be in a certain state, to have a certain set of connections or a certain pattern of connectivity in your mind. To know something is to not be able to not know it. And I know that sounds kind of circular, but if you think about looking at looking at a Where's Waldo diagram, and when you find Waldo, you can't unfind him again. You now know where he is. Or if you're looking at a pattern, if you have a bunch of dots in front of you, you look at those dots and then you see a pattern. Oh, there's a pattern, and then you can't unsee it. Or if you've ever stared at clouds, if you've seen clouds in the sky, you look at the cloud, and the cloud looks like a cow. But once the cloud looks like a cow, you can't make it not look like a cow anymore. You're sort of committed to that cloud being a cow. Knowledge is recognition. Knowledge is seeing patterns. And once you see that pattern, you can't unsee that pattern. Okay, that's covering the questions then that have been asked. I'm going to move on to the next slide now. Thanks for the questions. I really like those questions because they're digressions, but I think they're really useful digressions. The next slide is, where is the personal learning environment? The personal learning environment is, if you will, one node in this network. And this is a really important concept because our experience with applications like, say, learning management systems or learning design systems is that you'll have one application and then you'll have a whole bunch of people use it. Even things like this World Bridges setup here, where we have a website and we all go to the website. We have one website and a whole bunch of people are using this website all at once. And certainly in learning management systems, where you have the university sets up a learning management system, and then all the students go to the learning management system. And so when we think about learning management systems, we're always trying to adjust the learning management system. If we're trying to personalize the learning management system, this is happening in this centralized location. The personal learning environment, on the other hand, basically is an environment where there's one application per person. I have my PLE, you have your PLE, Dennis will have his PLE, Kathy will have her PLE. We each have our own PLE. And then the way the PLEs work is each one of these PLEs acts as an independent autonomous agent communicating in a web of connections to other personal learning environments, to other autonomous agents. So basically, what this personal learning environment is intended to do is to set you up with the capacity, the ability to be a node in a connectionist network. And you notice in so doing, what it has the effect of doing is embedding you or immersing you in that network. Clicking slide. I'm on the way networks learn is the way people learn. The idea here is that you immersing yourself in a network is the same way you learn yourself. Oh, this slide is so out of context. Let's pretend I just didn't present this slide. We'll move on to the next one. There's different ways that networks learn, different ways that networks organize themselves. Remember I was talking before about the way knowledge becomes a pattern in a network. Well, the way this works is when you have a whole bunch of individual networks connected to each other, or sorry, a whole bunch of individual entities connected to each other, they organize themselves. So if you think about you managing your own contact list. You add people, you subtract people. Sometimes you read people, sometimes you don't read people. You can sort of see the connections changing even over time, right? When I joined Facebook, for example, all of a sudden I got a whole bunch of new connections because other people who were on Facebook connected to me. So my personal network environment kind of shifted, kind of changed. And this is what happens. This is the network itself learning. As each one of these connections is made, the network is learning a little bit. Now, this slide describes the different ways that networks can learn. One way is by associationism. People who have common interests tend to connect to each other. Another way is through backpropagation. They engage in communication and you put forward an idea and then the corrections or the amendments to that idea come back to you from other people. And then another one is called Boltzmann mechanisms. It's a bit hard to explain, but it's you just settling into a network that feels natural, that feels comfortable to you. An example of this might be you'd settle into a network of about 100 people because 300 is too many and 50 is too few. So you just sort of settle into that 100 size network. Clicking slide. That model of connected nodes creating a learning network leads to a model of personal learning. And this model is basically a description of how an individual will want to behave in that network to function as an autonomous entity in that network, in a network where diversity, connectedness, and openness are preserved. It's the model of personal learning, and it's kind of in slogan form here. To teach is to model and demonstrate. To learn is to practice and reflect. Although, you know, I still think that the distinction between teaching and learning is, even here, a bit artificial. Or really, what we want to say here is that to be a learner in a learning network is to model and demonstrate, is to practice and reflect. These are the four activities that we want to engage in using our personal learning environment in the network. Clicking slide. So I'm on a slide now. What is the personal learning environment? And here we have an overview or outline. I will admit I borrowed the structure for this diagram from Clark Quinn. He had a similar diagram. He presented it at the e-learning guild conference in Boston. We have the four major things: model and demonstrate, practice and reflect. These are the four activities. And then the thing with the arrows, that represents the path of the individual, the activities or the actions of the individual. The individual making choices, choosing what to connect to, choosing what to read, choosing what to create. The individual having an identity that persists so that they can engage in different nodes of the network and still preserve their own identity. And then all of this leading to the individual being creative, the individual producing things and passing them forward through the network. And yes, Anne, it is pretty much an experiential learning model. So we break this down now. We can get an idea of what the personal learning environment looks like by drilling down into the pieces. So I click slide. I'm on the slide titled Model. Cheryl is saying, but historically our education system has not valued collaboration. Teachers were and still are isolated. But with all the networks available, there is not reason for that still to be. That is quite right. And it's interesting that the first reaction of our educational system, once the capacity to connect with each other became widespread, the first reaction was to shut that down, to block access, to prevent people from being able to connect with each other. The first part then of the behavior is the modeling behavior. If you think about the different types of modeling behavior we might want to undertake online, we can create models like concept maps or Gliffy. I don't know if you've seen Gliffy. I think it's just Gliffy.com, which is an application that allows you to create flowcharts and similar sorts of diagrams. And there's a whole bunch of applications like that are out there now. Creating reference frameworks, models of the world as we understand. If you think about Wikipedia really is a model of the world, the way we understand it all collectively. But that's not the only way to model the world. We can model the world via video, and so we have applications like YouTube. We can model the world in 3D representations, and there we have we see the appeal of Second Life. The idea that we can create these models and then interact with these models. Clicking. The next activity is to demonstrate, to be able to show, to explain. And so we have, for example, reference examples. People learning to program, what they do very often is they look at examples of previous programs that other people have written. That's how I learned how to create web pages, right? I just grabbed the web page off the web, I looked at the source, and then I began changing. They had color equals blue, I changed it to color equals red. And we can learn through these reference examples. Or thought processes. This is one of my favorite examples. A guy called Jerry Pournelle, who's well known as a science fiction writer, used to write a column in Byte magazine called Chaos Manor. And what he would do is he would engage in certain tasks, like, say, trying to install a driver on his computer. And he would describe his effort trying to do this task, and he would describe not just the things that worked, but also the things that didn't work. And not just what he did, but what he was thinking when he did it. Why he tried this rather than that. And it really showed not just how to install something, but the sort of mindset that you need to be in order to install something. We have other examples of demonstrations. Case studies are very popular, of course, in business, or stories are another example of demonstration. Looking at the comments again, you're reflecting on what Stephen is saying. Exactly. This, as you're listening to me and you're chatting back and forth, that's the reflective process in action. Practice. Supported practice. I've changed it. The previous slide said scaffolded practice, and I'm not really sure I liked that wording. But there is a sense there. If you look at the design of video games or digital games, they will get you to practice, and you'll practice different things at different times. If you're learning to fly an airplane, for example, you'll practice simple takeoffs and landings, and then you'll practice takeoff and landing in high wind, and then you'll practice takeoff and landing while somebody else is shooting at you. So your practice is, you know, you go through different levels. So it is, in a sense, scaffolded, but mainly what it is you're learning new skills each time. So it's actually a set of different practices. And yes, as Cheryl says, engagement is the key. Actually getting into that cockpit and trying to fly that airplane, that's what the key is. You can't explain to somebody or describe to somebody or have a question-answer session with somebody on how to fly an airplane. It just doesn't work. It's like Michael Polanyi said in Personal Knowledge, knowing how to ride a bicycle. You can't explain how to ride a bicycle. The way you learn how to ride a bicycle is you get on the bicycle and you learn how to ride the bicycle. And it's not just that it's hard to explain. It's that the skills involved in riding a bicycle quite literally cannot be expressed in words. They are, to use his word, ineffable. And this is the thing. This is a major distinction between connectionist knowing artificial intelligence or expert system type knowing. In connectionist knowing, there are things that we know that cannot be expressed in words. There are things that we know that cannot be measured. And it's this is recognition thing. There have been a bit of a discussion recently on how do you judge the effectiveness of a blog. And I've been taking the line, to actually come out and try to measure parts of it is just ridiculous. And the reason why I say it's ridiculous is the value of a blog is one of these ineffable properties. We cannot express it. We cannot measure it. It's like thinking of, what is the value of a friend that you have? Well, is it some particular quality of that friend? Well, no, it isn't. It's the totality of qualities, and they're different for each person. Is it the number of friends? Well, no. One friend, two friends, there's a different number for each person. So friendship is something, again, that is ineffable. You can't nail it down. You can't quantify it. You can't, do a question-answer session to determine whether someone is or is not a friend. Finally, clicking slides, we have reflection, and again, we've got reflection going on here in this chat room, in this chat area. How to play a violin, that's another good example. Imagine trying to describe to somebody how to play a violin. And what's the quantification, you know, if you're being tested on how well you can play a violin, what's the quantification there? You know, 44 people out of 50 clapped? When you push that a bit, you actually find that if you try to nail it down to specific properties that we can express in a sentence or with a formula, we find that we're misrepresenting what it is to actually be able to play a violin. Being able to play a violin isn't getting people to clap. It isn't hitting exactly the right note. More reflection, of course, you can have guided reflection where reflection is actually supported through templates or something. I was in the airport just a few days ago, and I've got these books out now. And it's kind of interesting if the slogan is something like, write it down because your memories fade or something like that. And they're books designed around recording specific types of experience. So there's one book, it's vacation experience. Another one I thought was quite funny, my football book. And it was to record every football game that you watched. And each page of the book was a template for inputting information about the game that you watched, right? You know, who were the teams? What was the weather? What time of day was it? What were the big plays? What was the crowd like? All the different sorts of things that you might think about as a football game. And what's neat is once you've written it down, then you can go back and reflect on that game. You think about that game. You have 10 years later, you look back through this season. Oh yeah, I remember that season. That season's a lot like this season, and it gives you an insight on this season from your recollection of that season. Other things that we do, of course, is journaling through blogs and wikis, and some people really like things like Twitter, and more reflection in communities. Discussion lists and things like that where people interact. All of this interaction is essentially a process of reflection. And if you think about it, this reflection is where things like back propagation happen. This reflection is where we put forward our ideas and see how they fare out there in the world. Clicking slide. Finally, the path, if you will, through this, the path that the owner of the personal learning environment takes is choice, identity, creativity. They engage in simulated or actual environments that present tasks or problems. We usually represent learning as passing information back and forth, passing content back and forth. And remember how I described learning design and the Lego model? It's all about deciding which kind of package of information, which piece of information or learning object to present to a learner next. And so it's a very communicative model, but this model is more a model of placing ourselves into environments. And you know, right now in Web 2.0 we're working with things like applications that let us write essays, applications that let us blog, applications that let us create diagrams. And these are good applications, but as time goes by, our applications are going to become more immersive. They're not going to be focused so much on the content that we consume and create, but rather they're going to be involved in setting up an environment in which there is content, but the content is incidental to the environment. So if you think, for example, of online games where you might be piloting a submarine, you have content coming at you and you have content that you're creating, but that content is separate, is secondary to the activity of piloting the submarine. And we're going to be seeing more of that. And again, that's the appeal of Second Life, is the creation of one of these environments. Now, I've criticized Second Life, but I haven't criticized Second Life for what it is. I've criticized Second Life because it's too commercial, because it's one single central place that we all have to go to, things like that. But the idea of having an immersive environment where we can undertake these activities, I think, is one of value. The things that are going to make this kind of structure work, OpenID, so that we can have our own definition of our own identity, and so some way of creating a mechanism for preserving that identity as we go from one system to another system. Also a way to develop our profile, a way to I would say feature development. If you think back to the old wizard games, some MUDs and things like that online, a person would have an identity, and as part of that identity they'd have a whole bunch of different properties. For example, experience points or wisdom points or power points or whatever they were. Now, I'm not suggesting that people have experience points or wisdom points on the web as a whole, but they will have properties. They will have accomplishments, for example, in different environments. They might have solved the such and such quest on such and such a website, or they may have a certain standing within a community as represented by such and such. Maybe they get votes from members of the community or whatever. I'm speculating here because most of this doesn't exist yet. But the idea here is that it's not just an identity that is being carried forth and presented to each of these different sites. It's not just an identity that consumes and creates. It's an identity that acquires properties, that is associated with a profile. I have a clock ringing behind me. I have no idea how distracting that is. And then finally, places for the stuff that we do create, portfolios or creative libraries, or in my case, to websites and things like that. So that's my overview of the personal learning environment, and clicking to the last slide, that's my talk as a whole. You can see the movement from an old style of education to a new style of education, from presented learning to personal learning, from learning design to learning networks. So I thank you for your interest, and for any comments or questions, I'll be happy to take some.
And the Education Bridges guys gladly yield some of their time to the esteemed EdTech gentleman from Moncton, so we can have some Q&A time. If anyone would like to ask a question or make a comment and you're in the Skype cast, let me know in the text chat and I can unmute you.
Dead silence.
Nina, did you have a question? Or not?
Well, I could chime in, I suppose. There's dead space here. I'm a great dead space person. Am I audible?
Yes, you are.
Yeah, okay. I hear you.
Okay. I'm very much like your... I suppose your theories resound with me quite a bit. And by the way, a lot of times when I'm out jogging and things like that, and you say hi to me, I really appreciate that. But I listen to a lot of podcasts. And in any event, we see our community. You're engaging now with community webheads, and in some ways, you described our community. And I mentioned at one point that it was like cat herding, because we have a joke here. That is, there is no leader really. It's so because there's no such thing as a cat herder. It can't be. But anyway, we sort of like that that aspect. I don't know what you know. And also this idea of learning from one another. I asked this question to Ken Winger the other night. If from talking to us, he had learned anything from us. I guess I'm curious about not only how we learn from our speakers, which we obviously do, but I just wonder if there's something that, having encountered this community, if you've altered your theories in any way, perhaps, for example, listening to Gavin, you're reflecting on Second Life. I just wonder what sort of reflections you're having as a result of awareness of us and having prepared a talk for us and that sort of thing.
Well, I've been aware of the webheads for a long time. So, to be honest, there's nothing in this particular interaction that I would say, oh, this caused me to think that. Because this interaction is just the latest. I'm not, of course, at all like a vocal member of Webheads or anything like that, but you know, a lurker, if you will, watching. You know, I've watched Webheads develop over a number of years, so there has to be some part of that experience of watching Webheads develop that has informed my understanding. You know, and it's I put Webheads sort of as an example of these self-organizing learning communities, and there are quite a number of self-organizing learning communities. I always remember a talk by Erin Brewer. She talked about self-organizing learning communities in Yahoo groups, and one of her examples was the community of beekeepers. And again, it's the same sort of structure, right? It's a bunch of people who have an interest in beekeeping, and it turns out you can't organize beekeepers either. You know, and each one of them interacts with the rest of that particular group in their own way. Part of my thinking about online groups like this that has evolved a fair bit over the last year is trying to draw out the distinctions between groups and networks. And so I look at something like Webheads, I sort of ask myself, well, is it fit more of a network or does it fit more of a group? Is there a clear dividing line between being in the group and being out of the group? Are there certain conditions for being a member of the group or not being a member of the group? And so these sorts of things I look at, you know, how open is the group? But again, you know, this is all part of a long-term knowledge of Webheads and not this particular conference in particular. I know that was really vague.
Well, you know, I think you've sort of put your finger on it, because the things that resound with me about when I listen to the things you say, which tend to sort of re-say it, I would say, well, anyway, you emphasize the points often about knowledge and networks and distributed learning networks and this sort of thing, and I think that you may have just put your finger right on it. That is, it's not necessarily a group. We call ourselves a group. We have a Yahoo group, but it's not really a group. It's a network, exactly. And of course, it overlaps with many other networks. And you know, World Bridges, for example, a very fascinating network. So it's the network aspects. And as George Stevens said the other, well, as he's written and said often, you know, it's not the knowledge that's exchanged. It's the network that creates the possibility for the exchange of knowledge. That's the important thing. So I think that's, I think I'm reflecting now as I'm talking to you, so I appreciate that. On to the next question.